Welcome to Component 4, which is entitled Introduction to Information and Computer Science. This is specifically Unit 8, which has the name Security. In this unit, our objectives include gaining the abilities to list and describe common security concerns, describe safeguards against common security concerns, including firewalls, encryption, virus protection software and patterns, programming for security, and so on. Describe security concerns for wireless networks and how to address them. List security concerns and regulations that relate to healthcare applications. And finally, describe security safeguards used for healthcare applications. It seems appropriate to begin our discussion by asking the question as to why we should be concerned about the security of our computers, our data, and our networks at all. And the answers are seen here on the screen. We are concerned about lost, stolen, or compromised data. When we talk about compromised data, that means that perhaps somebody sees information they should not have, or somebody has seen information and then made changes to it that are not authorized. We might encounter identity theft and even impersonation. For example, somebody steals your identity and then impersonates you by using your credit card. Network security and data security can also represent downtime for businesses. If a company's website, such as Google or Amazon, even eBay, are not secure, think of what would happen if they had to shut down their websites for 6 hours, or even a whole business day. What would the repercussions be for that specific business and to their customers? And then lastly, blackmail. If our data is not secure and the wrong person gets their hand on it, might we be threatened with disclosure of personal information that we don't want others to know about? Common threats to security include malware. And if you look on the screen, we have the definition, which is taken from Wikipedia. The slide notes list the source of this definition. According to Wikipedia, malware, which is short for malicious software, is software designed to infiltrate a computer system without the owner's informed consent. And I'm sure that you know the routine. You accidentally click on a file, which in turn forces an installation program to launch and install something on your computer. You didn't approve the installation, it just happened. Or maybe you visit a web page and then you click on some link or some button that's on the page, and then this in turn installs software on your computer. All of us find this very frustrating, and we need to be on guard against having this type of software installed on our computers. Types of malware include trojans, viruses, hoaxes, worms, phishing attacks, macroviruses, and then hackers themselves. Let's take each of these one at a time on upcoming slides. First up is the Trojan horse. A Trojan horse is a malware program that usually impersonates a known good file which was installed on your computer, and then the Trojan horse replaces the known good file with itself. This is getting more difficult to do with the updates in security in Windows operating systems, but they still do exist. The Trojan horse gets its name from the Greek Trojan horse myth. The Trojan then does its dirty work on a certain date through a user action or even on command. We've all heard of the stories of folks creating programs, installing them on servers or other devices, and then waiting for a date to come up. Then when that date appears, the program launches itself and then destroys certain files on the computer, or even all of the files that are on the computer. And so with that in mind, Trojans can destroy or copy data, install adware and other programs, or even install a browser toolbar. Trojans can also record keystrokes and then send this information to an attacker. And then they're using that information to further scan and attack your system. Lastly, Trojans can scan computer ports. As you're probably aware, computer ports can be likened to telephone extensions on a phone system. And so your computer has approximately thousands and thousands of ports that are available for communication purposes. A Trojan can scan a communication port and then look for information to pass through it and then in turn send that to an attacker. A virus is a computer program that can harm a computer and make it inoperable. Indeed, some viruses disable important operating system functionality. For example, a virus may remove the ability to back up a hard disk. Some viruses will try and be successful in even formatting a hard disk. Some viruses are only an annoyance. Viruses usually don't make copies of themselves on other computers, they just act. Removing a virus usually cleans the computer, assuming that's the only virus on the computer. Some viruses do make copies of themselves, and then if one copy is removed, then the other replaces the removed virus. And so it's really difficult to clean the system, and oftentimes the best response is to format the hard disk and reinstall the operating system, or restore from a backup. Sending a virus via email usually does replicate the virus, because all it takes is somebody to click on an email to give it focus so that they can view it in a preview pane or even to open the email. In 2008, the fun.exe virus spread itself via email throughout the world and was very difficult to remove, as it made millions of copies of itself on infected computers. It's important that we take a moment to consider what are referred to as macroviruses. Macroviruses usually infect Microsoft Office files and install themselves when users click or give focus to files. A macro is a small program which is usually written in Visual Basic for Applications. This is known as VBA. In fact, all Microsoft Office files have the ability to have VBA code written inside of them for functionality. And VBA code in itself isn't bad, it's the people who write programs for bad purposes who are bad. Macroviruses, as I mentioned, spread when users click files in which the macrovirus resides. And as a side note, we should add that most of us would be totally unaware that a virus is inside of a file, because its actions are silent. When we click on the file, we typically would have no idea that something bad was going to happen. Macroviruses may also delete files and disable Windows functionality and so on an infected system. And this is just another reason to be sure that anytime you receive a file from somebody, or an email with attachments, or an email all by itself, that you not even click on it by giving it focus, unless you're sure of who it came from and you trust that person. Personal information attacks are accomplished through the use of something referred to as phishing. Notice how it's spelled on the screen, with a PH. Phishing is an attempt to trick you into revealing personal information to an attacker so that they can impersonate you. And as I mentioned, this is pronounced like the word phishing, except for in this case, the attacker is phishing for information about you. So you might receive an email that appears to be from your bank, eBay, or even Amazon, asking you to log in to verify a transaction or to verify your username and password. You should never respond to one of these email requests, because your bank or your financial institution, or actually any reputable internet merchant, would never ask you to do that. And so if you receive an email of that sort, you should contact the institution being impersonated and report it to them so they can investigate. In fact, when you click a link that's shown in a phishing email, the website that opens looks as you would expect it to. For example, if it came from your bank, then the website that appears looks mostly like your bank's website. But if you carefully look at it, sometimes you can spot spelling errors or slight variations in colors. So it even has the spot where you can log in and so on. But do not ever do that. Always report the attack to your organization so they can do something about it. We should also mention that most email software, such as Microsoft Outlook, includes the ability to monitor for phishing activity and then move the suspected email to a non-functional folder. And this folder has the actual name of junk email. And so then an email that sits in that folder has no ability to create any actions. It's basically quarantined and isolated from the rest of the computer system. A worm is a program that works to create a lot of network traffic. We should note that some worms are not malware, as they crawl the network searching for information to report to network administrators. In this case, they're placed there by network admins network administrators know that these files are, or that this process is happening, and they don't work to stop it. And so worms that are malware, though, replicate themselves, usually, and they make the network unusable by putting so much traffic on the wires or in the air. You can liken this to everybody getting out of work in a large city at 5 p.m. and immediately jumping in their cars and getting on the same highway. That's really what a worm does. As a side note, the I Love You worm successfully attacked millions of computers when users clicked the attachment in May of 2000. When users clicked the attachment, the worm then made copies to itself of itself and then sent these copies to every contact that was in your email list. Hoaxes are usually harmless and attempt to convince you of something that is not true. Hoaxes usually come to you in the form of an email. Some hoaxes, which are harmful, invite you to send money to someone in another part of the world. Others ask you to contribute to find missing children, and so on. In some cases, the funds for missing children are true, but in most of the cases, they are not. And we continually hear of stories of folks who receive email asking them to send money to another part of the world. For example, send us $10,000 and we'll send you $50,000. And so people actually still, in today's world, fall for these types of attacks. So if you receive an email and it appears to be a hoax, then use your search engine to determine whether the email's message is true by entering the email's subject line in a search engine. And so if the email has a subject line of missing child in some city, then enter that in the search engine line and then put the word hoax at the end. The result set that you see will usually indicate whether the email is a hoax or not. In a corporate atmosphere, if you receive this type of email, you should report it to your network administrator. It's important to use trusted internet sites to detect hoaxes, and so when you look through your result set from your search engine, you should look for Snopes or for Urban Legends Online, to name two, and the link is here on the slide. They will actually put a picture or an image of the email you received on their site and tell you whether their investigation reveals it is true or not. You should never forward email chains, which are typically hoaxes, without verifying their source and identifying them as true. Let's now turn our attention to hackers and how they operate. Hackers are typically people who work to break a computer's security. Sometimes they do this to destroy data or to steal data on a computer. Other times, hackers just want to break into a computer because they can do it. One thing that hackers do is employ the use of something called a packet sniffer, which can read internet traffic. Wireshark is a free packet sniffer. It's also known as a protocol analyzer software tool that can display on a screen unencrypted network traffic so that they can see it. And so, for example, if a hacker was running a packet sniffer and was sniffing the area that you were sending an email on, they would be able to see the email that you sent in clear text on their screen. Well, if you send passwords, usernames and passwords to yourself, or if you store them in email, then they may be able to gain access to those. And so packet sniffers can serve a lot of purposes. One of them is to gain information so that a computer can be attacked. Hackers like to use this information to install malware in the form of adware, which just puts ads on your screen and is annoying and makes your computer almost useless, and spyware, which reports on sites that you visit and then perhaps even reports on information that you have stored on your computer. Some hackers try to infiltrate a computer system by guessing at usernames and passwords, and so this puts it on our shoulders as computer users never to use what I refer to as easy-to-guess passwords. And so you should change default username and passwords on wireless routers and on computers so that hackers just can't easily guess them and then gain access to the device. And so this leads us to the concept and to the topic of network security. According to Wikipedia, in the field of networking, the specialist area of network security consists of the provisions and policies adopted by the network administrator to prevent and monitor unauthorized access, misuse, modification, or denial of the computer network and network accessible resources. I know that sounds like a lot, and so in plain English we could say that network security is about the rules that we set up for use of equipment, software, and data, and how we follow our own rules. When I say we, this refers to network administrators in a corporate environment, and to the person or persons responsible for network security in a home environment. The use of assets revolves around authentication, authorization, and providing permissions for the use of network assets. In other words, if you can't prove your identity somehow, then you don't gain access to the network, its equipment, or its data. Let's talk about this in a little more detail. And so let's start with authentication, which is really the beginning of network security. With authentication, a user provides a valid username and password, typically, and this is referred to as their credentials. When the user enters their credentials, then the computer authenticates them against its user account and password database. In other words, if you log in successfully, you are authenticated. If the credentials entered match what's in that database, the user is authenticated, and servers typically authenticate users using a special type of database known as an Active Directory database. And this directory stores information about all users, user groups, computers, printers, and so on. And so an authenticated object, notice now we're using the term object, is a user who proved her identity, or a computer program that a server is able to positively identify, or a server that other devices, meaning servers, computers, printers, and so on, are able to positively identify, and so on. Authenticated users are next authorized. Now, these terms might seem confusing, but you'll get used to hearing them. And so authorization means that the computer indicates precisely what the user, or if we wanted to be more generic, what the object can do. And some examples include that we would allow a user to print files using specified printers. In other words, you can't use our printer unless you've been authorized to do so. Perhaps authorization includes gaining access to specified network drives. For example, if we allow users to store files on a server, then we would first authenticate and then authorize the user and then grant them access to that network drive so that they could read or store new files there. Authorization means that a user may be able to change and or view documents and folders, and they may be able to use company email. And then on top of all of that, these actions that we just mentioned are usually recorded for audit later. And this means that we can prove that we actually are authenticating and then authorizing users to be permitted to perform these actions within our network. Now, you notice that I use the term objects, and I'm using that often in this discussion. Users, computers, printers, scanners, and other things are referred to as objects in the IT world. In reality, objects are authenticated and authorized on a computer network, even though I'm sometimes using the term user. But really, we refer to objects. Other examples of objects, in addition to what we mentioned on previous slides, include tables in a database, a text field on a web form, a file, a folder, and so on. As a future health informatician, you will use this term quite a bit in future classes and in your everyday work. And so let's take a moment and verbalize what we've discussed in the last few slides, and I'd like you to do this with me. I'd like you to actually talk to yourself while you're listening to this. And so are you ready? So one of the first things that we employ in network security is authentication. And this is where a user enters their credentials, which is made up of a username and password, typically. Once a user has been authenticated against the Windows-based computer or server's database, then the user can be authorized. Once a user is authorized, then that authorization includes associating the user account or whatever the object is with permissions. And so we have authentication, authorization, and then permissioning of objects. part of authorizing an object is determining the position or permissions to which that user account or object should be able to use. So permissions determine what an object can or cannot do on a computer or a network. Two types of permissions are typically used. The first one is known as a sharing permission, and this allows one object to connect to or use another object over the network. And so let's say that you and your sister have a computer. You have two computers. On your computer, you have a number of family pictures that you've taken digitally and stored on your computer. You create a folder, and then you share out that folder to your sister. From her computer, she connects to your computer and then gains access to that folder. You did that through the use of sharing permissions. In addition to sharing permissions, we would next have to set up what are referred to as NTFS permissions. NTFS determines what one object can or cannot do to another object. And this would mean, would you allow somebody to have access to your pictures and then delete one? Or would you just let them read it? Would you allow them to perhaps not delete it, but change its name? Would you allow somebody to add a new picture to your folder? And so on. Those are the NTFS permissions that you would have to apply to the folder to determine what users can and can't do on your computer. NTFS is the New Technology File System and applies to all current Windows operating systems. In reality, NTFS is not new anymore, as it's been around since approximately 1993. In this discussion of authentication, authorization, and permissions, we only scratch the surface of its depth. And so, as you can imagine, permissions are a complex topic. And so let's look at this one more time so that you can put it together in your mind. Sharing and NTFS permissions on a Windows-based computer work together. And so, you create a folder on your computer so that your sister can copy pictures that you took. Next, you share the folder and set her permissions to change. And then lastly, you set NTFS permissions to read so that she can view and copy pictures. Without this type of a configuration, your sister will not be able to view or copy files from your computer. So notice this partial snapshot of a desktop. And we have the folder, which is shown in the top left corner with the name of pictures. And so we right-click the folder and then select properties from the menu that appears. And so here, we've already clicked the share button, which is slightly grayed out. This means that we've already configured the folder for sharing. And notice how right next to the yellow icon in the pictures properties dialog box showing here that it says pictures is shared. Now, we click advanced sharing to configure sharing permissions for this folder. Let's look at some of the detail that's shown here on the screenshot. The name of the computer, do you see it? It is John-PC. The name of the shared folder is Pictures. And so with proper configuration, your sister can open this folder by opening any window or browser and typing the following text in the address line. And if you attempt to do this and then access the shared folder from another computer, you want to get the syntax here, which are all of the dashes and the backslashes and so on, correct. And so you would type in on some Windows address line, /John-PC/pictures. And it has to be typed exactly like that. Those are backslashes, not forward slashes. If you type forward slashes, you'll get an error. And so how do you differentiate between backslashes and forward slashes? Well, look at them for a moment. Now, when you look at a runner running across the screen, typically the runner is going to start from your left and run to the right. And so if this were a runner, if those two slashes were runners, would they be leaning towards the back or towards the front of the race? Well, we could say that the runner was leaning backwards. And I'm referring to the two backslashes before the name John. A forward slash would lean forward. Notice that the name of the computer is preceded by these two backslashes. And this tells us that the computer to be accessed is not on the internet, and is on the local network, or on the intranet. If John PC was your computer, You could test this configuration to see that you've set it up properly by typing the following text in an address line. And so you would open a folder on your computer or open your browser and type in /localhost/pictures. Notice in all of this typing there are no spaces. The keyword localhost in networking always refers to the computer that you're sitting in front of, that you're working on. And so then you could, for example, if you typed in the keyword localhost /pictures with all the text there, then you would see what somebody else would see if they were attempting to log into your computer. We still have that same pictures properties dialog box open, but now we've clicked the security tab so that we can configure NTFS permissions. Group or usernames are listed in what is called an access control list, or ACL. And so the ACL here is we have a group or username of administrators, and so these would be user accounts that are members of the administrators group on this computer. Administrators have full control over this folder and its contents. This means that a user who is a member of the Windows administrators group can do anything to this folder and to its contents. Anything means that they can view, add new files, delete existing files, change existing files, create subfolders, and so on, and so on. If you wanted to make changes to the group or usernames listed, you would click Edit, and then you would be able to add a new username or group to the access control list for this folder.